Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa and I'm here with Linda, Pat, Heather, Stephanie and Nicola.
Hello!
Hi!
Today we'll be celebrating World Mental Health Day. Heather will be sharing some work in progress, and Nicola and Jackie Smith will be telling us what's on their bedside tables. Stephanie will be insulting us, and we'll be discussing our writing lives. By the way, one member of our Facebook group, Frank Carver, is diligently working his way through his Write Club the Podcast bingo card. We might have to think about giving him a prize when he completes all the tasks. Now, to kick off today's programme, Linda will ask us to
name the novel.
Indeed I will. I always worry about the clues. I mean, are they too hard? Are they too easy?
They're always too hard for me and too easy for Teresa.
That's not true. That's not true.
Well, let's see if I've got them well done here. Okay, first clue. Ready, everyone?
Yep.
In this 1927 modernist novel, action and dialogue take a back seat to thoughts and observations.
Okay.
She's getting it. Among the themes are loss, subjectivity, the nature of art, and the problem of perception.
Okay, interesting. So it's like a stream of consciousness type thing.
Let's see. Anyone?
No, I can't narrow it down more than that.
Ready? Clue two. A quote. What is the meaning of life? That was all a simple question. One that tended to close in on one with years. The great revelation had never come. The great revelation perhaps never did come. Instead, there were only little daily miracles, illuminations, matches struck unexpectedly in the dark. Here was one.
Got an inkling, but it's still not specific.
No one else?
I've got an idea.
Ooh. Okay. All right. Another one? Ready?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The setting is a summer house on the Isle of Skye in the Hebrides, Scotland, where the large Ramsay family and a group of their friends have gathered.
I don't know it.
Well, it's not Victor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, is it?
It's not Virginia Woolf, Mrs. Dalloway either, so...
No.
No, absolutely no idea.
You've stumped
well,
us.
Well, it is Virginia Woolf.
Yeah. I thought the style, yeah.
To the Lighthouse.
To the Lighthouse. Okay.
Yes. Well, it's a classic I have never read.
Well done to everybody out there who got it. Thanks, Linda. That was a tricky one. Now it's over to Heather for her work in progress.
This is part of the second part of my journal after the journey once we arrived. And this section is about my knee. One of our aims for life in Stupa was to stay fit and try to lose more weight. I'd lost 4 stone before we set off. We continually told ourselves that we were not on holiday, so we had to be careful. No ouzo on the balcony before heading into town for dinner. No postprandial metaxas to end the evening. We planned to go out maybe a couple of times a week, but otherwise eat a healthy diet at home. Wine was allowed. Although we had our car, we planned to walk as much as possible and to swim as often as we could. All sounds doable. All was going well until the 8th of October 2016. We set off from the house in the morning. I should tell you at this point that I was wearing my very new, very expensive, bright pink walking shoes. Our aim was to walk to Agios Nikolaos for lunch and then walking home again. How different the walk is now compared to our first time 30 years ago. The scrubby pathway and makeshift bridges have been replaced by a concrete walk cycleway, gently undulating by the side of the rocky shore. Always a magnificent walk at the best of times, and on this occasion it certainly was the very best. The weather was perfect, not too hot, but sunny with a gentle breeze coming in off the sea. We stopped for a drink at the taverna about halfway along the path, the perfect setting for a quiet rest overlooking the sea. I could sit and watch the sea for hours, but that wouldn't help keeping up my exercise regime. We continued on to Agios Nikolaos, and I suggested that we continue on to Agios Dimitrios. We actually got as far as Pentasi Beach, and Roy convinced me to turn back and find somewhere for lunch. He thought that I was being over-optimistic for our first long walk. Lunch of bread, oil and grilled sardines by the harbour was just what was needed. Refreshed, we set off back to Stupa. An ominous burning sensation in the ball of my left foot told me that maybe I should have brought a pair of well-worn shoes to change into. Hindsight is a wonderful thing. After a while, my left knee was a bit sore, but not too bad, and on we walked. When I got back into Stupa, I took off my shoes and paddled in the sea. Possibly a mistake. On examination, I had a spectacular blister. Not good. After a rest, I hobbled back up the hill, and when I checked, I'd walked 14.6 kilometres, 22,754 steps. Although my foot and my knee were rather sore, I was very proud of myself. During the night, I got out of bed and somehow managed to fall over, landing awkwardly on my right knee. The pain was incredible, but I told myself that I would be fine in the morning.
Thank you.
22,000 steps, whoa.
Yeah, but broke your body. Not good.
You were ambitious.
You see, yeah. I always say too much exercise is not
healthy. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's dangerous
absolutely.
Stuff.
Yeah.
I really like the chatty, intimate style of this. And I think you know about this, but you still tend to use a comma where something stronger is needed.
Yes.
I found quite a lot of those where I thought a full stop would have been
yes.
better, and you probably felt it when you were reading it that
yes.
you didn't have time to breathe.
That's right.
yeah, there's a nice descriptive sentence where you talk about the scrubby pathway and makeshift bridges
yeah.
have been replaced by a concrete walk. Gently undulating by the side of the rocky shore. So I think that's nice. That gives you a little bit of a sense of place. You know, my biggest criticism really is that the reader doesn't know how far these places are, what they are. When you say Agios Nikolaos, it could be a church, it could be a village, it could
yeah.
be a taverna. We don't know the distance. And
yeah.
What I thought about was, imagine this is in a magazine, and somebody you've never met before in Barrow-in-Furness or somewhere is reading it. What information do they need to understand that this is a long walk and that these places are, you know,
yeah,
how much further on it is?
You said we actually got as far as Pantasy Beach.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how far Pantasy Beach is, you know.
Yeah, what I've done is, and I suppose reading one little bit in isolation is quite difficult because I've put a lot of that explanation at the beginning.
Right, okay.
I've done
okay.
an introduction, you know, a little bit about,
yeah.
you know, how we got here, and then about the place, a bit of the history
okay.
of the place.
Right.
Okay,
because
that's...
I appreciate... So, yes, I take what you're saying, and I know about... when I read it out loud, I know about the
yeah.
situation.
Yeah. yeah.
And I need to... The only way I can do that is by reading it out loud.
Yeah, exactly. It takes time. It comes with
yeah.
time, doesn't it? And
yeah.
practice and
yeah.
experience.
But yes,
yeah.
I think you're definitely right. It does need to explain, but hopefully
yeah.
reading the whole thing
yeah.
will explain.
Yeah.
Plus you can always, because you were planning to put in pictures and
yes.
so on, you could almost include a map.
Yeah.
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a thought.
I picked up on, you said, the weather was perfect, not too hot. Sunny with a gentle breeze coming in off the sea. We stopped for a drink, the perfect setting for a quiet rest overlooking the sea.
Yeah.
I could sit and watch the sea for hours, and I just think you could maybe think about ocean waves.
Yes.
Water.
Blue water.
yeah.
You know, other words, so that we don't keep hearing the word sea.
Yeah.
And I think as well, that description is great, but I think smell is another thing when you're walking. The things that you catch on the air, I think that adds to description if you can involve all the senses, because you've got burning and heat and breeze, you've got all of those kind of feeling things and things that you see, but there's not a lot of smells in there.
I've started putting smells in just for Stephanie.
Yeah.
I read it and I think, oh, there's no smell. I better go back and smell it.
I do think smell adds to a description. I don't know what you might smell, but, you know.
Depends on
the minute you get off the plane,
it
smells different here.
Well,
yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've written something else yesterday that I did include, and I'd not realised I hadn't put it in here, but I've put about the sage and the salt.
Yeah,
and I put colours as well. I put all I've put about all the different shades of green. Mm. So finished product.
Yeah,
good.
No, I'm sure.
I don't find description easy either. No. So you know, I have to force myself to go back and put it in because
we all have different strengths and weaknesses, don't we? And that's what we're doing is talking about that and trying to help each other too.
I just think for any descriptive piece, if we always think about all of the different senses that we have and try to help the reader experience all of them, that's why.
Yeah, and way back at Christmas when we were talking about sex, if you remember, Sue Laybourne said, bring all the senses in when you, you know, when she's writing a sex scene, she tries to bring all the senses in. Isn't early in the morning the best time?
I thought we could break up some of the grey here in the first page by adding a paragraph or two. I thought a good place would be when we go from walking home again into how different the walk is now. Might be a good place to have a little break there. I'm always noticing too much grey. If it's too grey, then...
You mean the layout that it's blocks of text? Is that
Yes, and if they're too long, that's what I mean by too grey.
Not enough white space on the page.
But then also, I don't know if this is cliche or not, but it's something that we just hear all the time when you have lunch. It was just what we needed. I thought that sentence might be rearranged.
Okay.
And so, because it's a little...
Doesn't say anything, does
it?
When you think about it.
Yeah.
And also, grilled sardines have a very special smell.
True. They do. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Or if you're in a restaurant and something is taken to the table behind you, you go, they've got calamari.
Yeah.
You can smell it.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's another good step, if you will, in your journey. And it's always interesting to hear about where you've been and what you've done. But I think I've written here when Roy thinks it might be a little over optimistic. I said, me too.
can I put in a plea for, as opposed to just full stops instead of commas, a judiciously selected semicolon might be advantageous.
Okay. I agree. Yeah. Sometimes I put a semicolon.
Sometimes what you say following your comma is an expansion of what you've said before or an explanation or something like that, in which case colon or semicolon would be good.
I think the second sentence I've got, that we continually told ourselves that we were not on holiday, so we have to be careful, semicolon, no zone on the map.
Apart from lots of the sort of same points as other people, but I thought you could make more of that final paragraph. And so you went to bed, you were very quite sore, but you're very proud of yourself. And then during the night, you got out of bed, fell over.
That's not the end.
No, it just sounded...
Well, that's just a cut off for the words, not the end of the...
The word count for this.
Yeah. No, but the actual link into, I thought there was possibly an opportunity for... Because what's quite nice is the sort of self-awareness that comes through in the passage about, pointing out your nice new shoes and here... I don't know, I think it's like the sort of pride goes before a fall type of comment. Just needed a little bit of a...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully the next bit is going to be where I realise it's not going to be okay.
I didn't quite understand why paddling in the sea would be possibly a mistake.
Taking the shoes off was the mistake.
Yeah.
Okay, just hold on a minute while I get my crash helmet on, because I believe Stephanie has got some insults flying my way.
Well, it's not so much your way. It's I was just, those kind of books that you can dip in and out of, a book of quotations, and I just spotted a few quotes about writers and writing, and I just thought I'd share them with you. So Jean Cocteau was a French poet and writer, best known for his novel Les Enfants Terribles. Who's also a playwright, artist, and a filmmaker, and he said, "Poetry is a religion without hope. I know that poetry is indispensable, but to what? I could not say." So he was pretty damning. There'd been quite a lot of other quotes about poets. If you're still a poet after the age of 30, it's because you haven't grown up.
All right. Interesting.
Some pretty
And that's a bad thing?
Well, no, I don't think it's a bad thing. On writing and writers... Jack Warner said, what is a writer but a schmuck with a typewriter? So he obviously didn't think a great deal of
loads of respect for the scriptwriters.
Absolutely. And then Wilfred Sheed, who's an American novelist, he was English-born but he wrote in America, says, one reason the human race has such a low opinion of itself is that it gets much of its wisdom from writers. But I quite like Kingsley Amis's quote because it responds to that very well. It says, well, if you can't annoy somebody, there's little point in writing.
Yeah.
Oscar Wilde said, one should not be too severe on English novelists. They are the only relaxation of the intellectually unemployed. So perhaps we're intellectually unemployed.
Well, no. Perhaps we are.
George Orwell said, all writers are vain, selfish and lazy, and at the very bottom, their motives are a mystery. Thanks, George. Now, writers on other writers, what they've said, I quite liked. George Bernard Shaw on Shakespeare, it would be a relief to dig him up and throw stones at him. Ruth Rendell on Agatha Christie.
Oh.
Her stories are puzzles, not novels.
True.
The characters aren't even lifelike enough to be caricatures. I don't like Agatha Christie at all. Not kidding.
I think it's fair. In my opinion. Yeah. On that. But there you go.
And then there was a review of Pickwick Papers that was written way back in the day. Mr. Dickens writes too often and too fast. If he persists much longer in this course, it requires no gift of prophecy to foretell his fate. He has risen like a rocket and he will come down like a stick. But perhaps the best insults are reserved for the publishers. So Colin Haycraft was a very famous publisher, very well known in the UK and considered very much a gentleman of the profession. He said publishing is not a very difficult business. It's just most people are bad at it, and so it's very easy to look good. And David Mercer, the playwright, said, one day we shall strangle the last publisher with the entrails of the last literary agent. My favourite is Cyril Connolly, who was a literary critic. Or a literary cricket, anyway. There
one
you go.
Of the two.
He said, as repressed sadists are supposed to become policemen or butchers, so those with an irrational fear of life become publishers.
Excellent. Thanks, Stephanie. So it's that dread time when I ask you all what you've been up to writing-wise. Pat, have you been putting that new stationery to good use?
I have been sort of revisiting theory.
Oh, that's a good one. I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
I thought I was good. I was just going to say I've been doing research. Oh, that's really good.
No, I've been sort of looking and you're going to sort of say, oh, give us some titles. And I'm thinking, oh, I can't remember. Now, I've been sort of revisiting some of the articles and books and things that we've looked at over the last year or so about structure and planning and, you know, write your novel from the middle. And because I know with my very long short story that I need to go back and I need to shake it up a little bit and rework it. And I'm thinking I might actually go right back to bare bones to start again on it.
Right.
Maybe.
Okay,
that's about it, really.
Well, I've been trying to write the background of some of my characters, especially Eli, who's changing all the time from one personality to another.
Yeah. It's a balance, isn't it, between giving him a bit of colour, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it becoming possibly, I'm not saying it is, but it potentially it could become a bit inconsistent if you go too far one way.
He is now, I think. But it's interesting because when I sat down to try to write like we do sometimes with things like a Proust questionnaire or something, it didn't work that way. And it felt to me like, you know, my fingers were just sort of going and Eli was describing himself. That sounds a little precious, but yeah. I did feel that. But he rambles. But I've learned an awful lot about him so far and he talks about, you know, his wife, Mary Magdalene's mother, and so I'm getting a lot of good background from exploring him. And I think that he will reveal to me which one of these characters or personalities he really is as I continue.
But I think the rambling is interesting because as a preacher, this might sound a bit disrespectful to preachers, but does he not like the sound of his own voice?
Yeah, of course.
You know, so that's interesting. Yeah, yeah, that sounds really good. Sounds worthwhile. Yeah.
But in the beginning, he wasn't a preacher. So, but still, he's got that kind of thing going.
Yeah.
Also, going through what Nicola and I did the day when we went through the three-act structure, I've been putting together the bits that I had. And I have a lot more done than I thought I did. Yeah, I mean, I'm up right now to about 100 pages and double-spaced, of course, but that's far more than I realized I had written already. Yeah.
Well, I keep going back and having a little dabble with Grace, changing epigraphs and that sort of thing, but I've actually been playing around with some ideas for book two. And I've come up with a couple of characters, I think, might be interesting. One works in an undertaker's, 40, fat and frumpy, you know. So
stop looking at me.
I'm past 40. so I've been dabbling with that.
Excellent. Well done for starting something new. Anything happening with them agents and stuff?
No, I haven't heard anything, and I didn't get shortlisted for the Blue Pencil Agency competition, which was another one I entered. So. But I'm saving up my rejections.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Keep going.
Yeah, wait for 100. Yeah.
Nicola, you've been busy?
No. I've had one series of visitors after another, I had no idea until it happened that how time-consuming it is, even with visitors who are quite independent and, you know, used to taking themselves off. They still want to spend every minute of the rest of the time with you, which is lovely, but it makes for, you know, I'm struggling to get even my normal work done, let alone them.
Yeah, okay.
But, I was thinking, you know, I was thinking I've got to write some new stuff, really, because you've all heard everything pretty much now.
Right, okay.
So time to write some
more. Yeah, I'm getting a bit like that as well. Okay.
Yeah.
Heather?
Well, I've been trying to write my journal part two, and I found it really quite hard. So I was trying to find a format, and I tried doing it chronologically, and of course I can't remember because I didn't keep a journal as I did before.
Mm-hmm.
So I've decided to do the bit that I read today, sections, to see whether I can, you know, make it make a bit of sense. But as you pointed out today, looking at one bit in isolation is a bit odd. But that, you know, I've been asked to do it. One or two people who've read the journal have said they wanted to know what happened.
That's good. Yeah,
you know, what else have we got up to and what other silly things have we done? So hopefully it can be, you know, quite entertaining. And I've decided to enter a competition.
Oh. Good for you, Heather.
Are you continuing with your fiction?
I haven't done. I do need to go back. In our Write Club, I did a descriptive piece about India during partition. And so what I want to do is put that into the Rose story.
Because, that was brilliant. You know,
because I've not been good at the descriptive stuff. Yeah. So I thought if I put that in, I think it'll lift the story.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, I didn't win the Yeovil Prize, the Yeovil Short Story Competition. Yeovil is a place in Devon, I think.
Somerset.
Apologies to Yeovil. And I didn't get shortlisted or commended or anything, so that, you know, never mind, you can't win them all. But
I can't win any of them.
And other than that, I'm researching, as I said before. No, I'm looking at, for the novel, A Village Called Far Away, I'm looking at the backstory. So, as you may remember, there's an old lady dies in the opening chapter, but her backstory is quite important. So that goes back to the 1940s. So that's quite a lot of research about Athens at that time, the war years, the years of occupation, and the civil war that followed. It's problematic as well because, as you know, a lot of A Village Called Far Away is very light in tone and funny in parts. And obviously there's this very dark backstory. Well, it's not obvious, but it is going to be a very dark backstory. So I'm not sure how that's all going to work and come together. But we'll see.
Trust.
But I haven't actually done any writing.
The bottom line.
I've got a long way around to say it, but I haven't done any writing because I'm a naughty girl.
Can we count research as writing?
Research, it's all part of the process and plotting and thinking. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we're celebrating World Mental Health Day, which falls on October the 10th this year. Every year, one adult in four, along with one child in 10, will have a mental health issue. These conditions can profoundly affect literally millions of lives, affecting the capability of these individuals to make it through the day, to sustain relationships, and to maintain work. That's a quote from the World Mental Health Day website. Here at Right Club Podcast, I think we all feel quite strongly that anybody suffering from mental health issues, mental illness, should not be stigmatised. And we've all been touched by mental illness in our personal and professional lives. One of the things that interests me and that links us to books and literature is how society defines mental illness and how that definition changes over time. And Stephanie, you've done quite a lot of research about mental illness for your novel Lacking Grace.
I have, yes, because I was really determined from the outset that I wasn't going to fall into stereotypes and traps. And because I really, really want people to see Grace, who is defined and diagnosed as suffering from a mental illness. But I really wanted people to see Grace as a woman with problems, you know, because that's all mentally ill. You know, anybody that's mentally ill, it's no difference being, you know, physically ill, is it really? So I did a lot of research. One book that I started with was Elaine Showalter, The Female Malady, Women, Madness in the English Culture, 1830 to 1980, which really talks about how women in particular have been stigmatised for not behaving in the way that, you know,
patriarchy suggests. They should.
And then another one was the Lisa Apinasi, something like that, Apiginasi. It's called Mad, Bad and Sad, A History of Women and the Mind Doctors, which is really a grand tour of derangement from matricide to anorexia, according to John Leonard. Those two books really gave me the sort of background and the history and educated me in certain ways. I've then got a load of textbooks, Psychiatry Observed. This one is called Administrative Therapy. And you can see it's a very old book. It's about the role of the doctor in the therapeutic community. And the editorial advisory board consisted of professors of psychiatry and so on. So that was quite hard reading. It's a textbook for doctors who are treating people that are mentally ill in the, you know.
So that would give you a good insight into the treatments Grace would experience.
And then Psychiatry Observed, similarly, is a textbook. I also got a book called The Writer's Guide to Psychology by Carolyn Kaufman, because mental illness is so often misrepresented in literature.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I wanted to make sure that...
Avoid the pitfalls.
Yeah, that I was at least getting it right. Probably the biggest help to me was actually speaking to people who've suffered mental illness. And I'm very privileged to be a member of the International Hearing Voices Organisation, which has a Facebook group, and it's for people that hear voices. And very many of those people have been diagnosed as schizophrenic. Many others have not been diagnosed with anything. That they hear voices and they openly talk about hearing voices. And they've been really very, very generous in giving of their time.
That's amazing.
And I also spent a day with a lady talking about the fact she believes she was brain damaged by electroshock therapy.
Oh.
She gave me a day of her time to talk to me about her experiences of deep depression, of electric shock, because you know, I've never had, you know, electroshock therapy. How do I describe what it feels like to wake up after that? As I say, I didn't want to rely on the kind of stereotypes and the misrepresentations. You know, electroshock therapy was just one of the therapies, and there were all sorts of treatments that were given to try and help people. But when you read, I've read psychiatric journals from the 1930s and 40s, and at that time were saying lobotomy was a really good idea.
Yeah,
it worked.
Yeah.
But it was important to me that it was done properly. So I did spend a lot of time educating myself about
amazing.
It. Because although I love Ken Kelsey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the assumption there is that the Nurse Ratched was out to get them, and she wasn't a very nice person. And that may have been because the book was told from the point of view of the big Indian chief.
Mm, mm.
So maybe he saw her as out to get them, but I really don't believe that psychiatrists and doctors and nurses in the 1800s, their motives were to try and help people with mental illness. Yeah. Mental illness was, and still is, very, very misunderstood.
Yeah.
And thus the stigma. So, yeah, so I kind of made it my business to find out all that. And I can't thank enough all those people that have talked to me about their experiences. That, and it's incredible that people will, you know, if you ask and say, I'm interested, people will talk to you. Yeah. And I met one lady who has a delusion that she's an experimental, she's an animal that's being experimented on when she's psychotic. And she was incredibly open about this.
Yeah.
She sat there and, you know, as ordinary as you or I, telling me this is how she feels sometimes and how terrifying it is when she's got that belief. Well, you know, she's living with it. Yeah. You know, she's just an ordinary person.
And I know in Lacking Grace, Grace's voice is a big part of the story. And three or four years ago, maybe longer, the BBC had a detective series called River. And in that, the main character sees people that other people can't see, and they speak to him. And I have to say, it was very enlightening for me. There is someone that I see on a daily basis who's talking to people that I can't see. But I feel very comfortable with it now. And that's interesting. It's in a way that the writing of that programme has given me an insight and made me feel quite comfortable. He's just talking to the people I can't see. I feel fine with that now. It's not scary.
I would like to say that if you want to look at how the definitions of mental illness has changed over the years. I don't know if it's used in England, probably not. I think it's the American Association of Psychiatry. But they use the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, for looking up, for defining illnesses, and they use it as a guide for how to write up a diagnosis. And
we do have something similar.
Okay, and they... If you went back through the years and looked at specific illnesses that are in there, you would see things that have been left out, things that have been added, things that have been changed.
Well, epilepsy
is
considered a mental
illness. Right,
right. Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to say is Stephanie talked about the woman who feels she was damaged electroshock therapy. I had a friend who was suicidal and was very seriously ill with a deep depression. And she was brought back from the brink through electroconvulsive therapy.
Yeah.
So
I don't think we can make judgments.
No.
Because experiences are different, and it does depend on how it's administered.
Of course.
And so on. But it obviously works.
Right.
For some people.
Yeah.
But just as with drugs, you know, you take too many drugs, they can start to damage you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just don't want to discourage someone if you have someone who's needing this. I know you didn't mean that.
None of us are doctors.
Stephanie mentioned One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And what other representations of mental illness or mental institutions in literature have been significant to us?
Well, I really was struck by the yellow wallpaper.
Oh,
and that was by Charlotte Perkins Gilman or Gilman Perkins.
Yeah, one of the two.
and that was early. It's a very thin book, but it's a very important book. I think it was part of the feminist movement because the woman involved was suffering from or had given birth and probably had some postnatal depression or whatever. And so her husband and friend are trying to help her, and they do all the wrong things, isolating her, etc. And it's just an amazing look at this woman trying to survive these
treatments. I thought that was a wonderful portrayal.
It's an amazing story. Yeah,
it is.
And as you say, is it late 19th, early 20th century that it was written?
Yeah,
and then it's been picked up by feminist critics in the 70s as an example of, you know, how women are treated. Yeah.
And of course, Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar is very well known as a study of mental illness, and Antonia Frost, a lot of her work was around her own, you know, very much autobiographical around her struggles with mental illness.
We recently read The Wasp Factory again on our reading club, and it was my second go round, and the main protagonist was actually deeply mentally ill because of several reasons, but I found all of that fascinating. But some of the passages in it made me laugh out loud because having experienced mental illness with my mum, there are times when mental illness can be very funny because people are telling you things and you're trying to make sense of it in a rational sort of way, but they're telling you things that can never be made sense of, and they're really quite comical sometimes. And there were passages in that book where the brother was coming home slowly, travelling across country and getting madder as he came, and the younger boy was taking telephone calls, and the phone calls were absolute brilliant comic genius writing, you know, of anyone who's experienced that. So it's not all dark and gloom, you know, it can be quite funny sometimes.
One of the things that struck me was, I was sort of preparing, I thought, I can't think of any books that I've read that touch on mental health, so I googled. And things that came up were like Curious Incident.
Yes.
Eleanor Oliphant, Girl on the Train. And I thought, oh, of course. And that led me to thinking about the treatment of mental health in literature. Right. And to some extent, the way they're treated there, you're almost not aware that there is a mental health issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It becomes subservient to the story and the character and so on.
You're taking the point of view of the person who apparently has an abnormal psychology, which kind of places you in their mindset, doesn't it?
And
you
see that
it all seems reasonable. And that's the interesting thing.
And compare that. The Mad Woman in the Attic.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How things have changed.
And absolutely. And who diagnosed her and who said she was mad and needed locking up?
But if you read The Wide Sargasso Sea,
which is on my list,
you'll have a very good idea of how she got there.
Yeah, exactly. So I think Jean Rhys wanted to kind of tell her story.
To go back to Nicola's point about how comedy comes into it. Poppy Shakespeare is a novel by Claire Allen, and it's very light-hearted and funny.
But
you really get to identify with a lot of the characters in that. So again, it's not all doom and gloom in The Bell Jar.
Well, one of my favourite books, and one of, I think, the most important books of the 20th century, if I dare say that, The Tin Drum by Gunter Grass. His opening paragraph says, "Granted, I'm an inmate in a mental institution. My keeper watches me, scarcely lets me out of sight, for there's a peephole in the door, and my keeper's eye is the shade of brown that can't see through blue-eyed types like me." So immediately you're told this narrator is in an asylum. But actually what you're talking about is a world that is insane, because it's about growing up in a world where, in the 1940s, where every adult worships Hitler, and it goes on into the war years and so on. So, you know, maybe insanity is the only safe haven or the only retreat, but it's about a lot more than that. It's a very complex and interesting book. But we quite often have the point of view of the person of abnormal psychology, don't we, in books, and that's interesting.
Actually just reflects how common mental illness is and always has been, probably. But in the olden days, you know, you didn't lock people up. You put them in the West Wing, if you were rich, or if you were poor, they just lived among the community.
Chained them in the corner or something. You know?
Well, perhaps you did that in England, in the South, in America. We put them in the front parlor and paraded them around.
And took money for people to visit.
And there's a fine line, isn't there, between deviance and mental illness and how that's portrayed. So at different times, like homosexuality, being a woman, challenging accepted values are deemed as almost in signs of insanity. That, you know, that. So, yeah, it's interesting. And there's lots and lots of reading out there.
It made me think about institutions and some of the things we've talked about. There's a book called The Scaligrig, which is the story of somebody who gets lost in the system.
Right.
And it's amazing.
Yeah.
He's taken away from his family. He's got physical disabilities as well, but he's put into the system. And it's the whole story of how he loses his personality, loses his name.
If you think of Maggie O'Farrell's The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox, that's a very similar story.
Is it?
She got lost and lost her name and nobody knew who she was and the family had forgotten her. That's a fascinating book as well. I don't know if anybody's heard of Kay Redfield Jameson.
Oh, yes.
She's a professor of psychiatry and she wrote An Unquiet Mind, which is a great study of mental illness. Night Falls Fast, which is about suicide. Touched with Fire, which is about manic depression. And she actually says that writers have depression or manic depression more often than others.
Yes.
And I have to say, is that because writing's lonely? Is it because of the constant rejection?
Well, is it it's a chicken and egg, isn't it?
Or is it, or are we or are we
introspective
people and creative people tend to write?
I think Kay Redfield Jameson had bipolar disorder and she had some very florid episodes, and I was so grateful to her for writing about these things. When I was working, I was an editor in a house where we published psychiatric newsletters and magazines, and so I had the opportunity to meet her and hear her lecture. And she's an amazing person to have. I think she manages very well now with medications, and she's an incredible woman to have come through what she's come through and be able to write so beautifully about it all. If you were to look at a list of writers through the years, and there are a list of people who had bipolar disorder or manic depressive illness, and they're very well represented in the field of writing. So I always thought, well, gee, maybe they have, if there's something like that going on, maybe they have greater access to other portions of the brain or something through this deviation. That could be, that's my thought. I don't know.
Yeah, and we've talked about writing being therapeutic, so perhaps the feeling that you need to get a story out, or the get feelings out.
Right.
Perhaps it's a therapy for writers.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Interesting.
So maybe the deeply felt emotional turmoil informs good writing.
I think it must.
It's nearly time to wrap up for this week, but before we do, there's just time for Nicola and Jackie Smith to tell us what's on their bedside table. Nicola?
I am currently reading In Deep Water by Sam Blake, which is the second book about Cat Connolly, the detective who everyone who's got into the books is really enjoying. And the interesting thing about this one, something big happened between book one and book two, which moved the action on and changed the circumstances of the protagonist. And it was very neatly done. And I really thought that was worth mentioning, because if you're interested in how to move along time and plot, then this is a really good example between book one and book two.
Interesting. Because, that must be an issue of linking one to the next in a series. Mm. Okay, over to Jackie.
Jackie Smith, travel and write blogger. What's on your bedside table?
Inside Hitler's Greece. And I've just started that book because I wanted to know more about the history of Greece during the invasion. Having gone to a restaurant in Platanos and seen as one of their wall decoration an old gas can that had belonged to the Nazi troops. So I decided I was going to do a little more research into that. And it's fascinating to read about the places that we all know and how they were.
Yeah. And the author, you know the author of that?
Is Mark Mazzoa.
That was interesting. Yeah, I can also recommend that book by Mark Mazzoa. It's very good. Sadly, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe on Radio Public, iTunes or Stitcher, so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a review, or drop by our Facebook group and introduce yourself. Goodbye!
Bye! Bye.